And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org. And if you want to hear other shows, other episodes of Writers on Writing, go to iTunes and subscribe to Writers on Writing. And when we podcast our shows, which is typically a few days after they air, it will pop into your inbox, your file for podcasts on your phone or computer, however you listen, and you won't miss an episode. In any case, I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I should say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are not those of the University of California Regents, but they're my views and my guests' views, and you can blame us or congratulate us. Today, my guest for the entire hour is Leslie Schwartz. She's a writer whose career has spanned three decades. She's been named a Calliope Magazine's Woman Writer of the Year and won many awards for her fiction and community service as a writer, including three Artists-in-Residence grants from the Los Angeles Department of Cultural Affairs, the West Hollywood Algonquin Award for Public Service in the Arts, and a California Council for Humanities Fellowship. Her two novels, Jumping the Green and Angel's Crest, have been published in 13 languages, and Angel's Crest was also adapted for the screen. Her essays and articles have most recently appeared in Salon, Lit Hub, The Rumpus, Brevity, and Narratively Speaking. And she's here primarily to talk about her new memoir, The Lost Chapters, Finding Recovery and Renewal One Book at a Time, published by Penguin Random House. Hi, Leslie.
Hello, good morning.
Great to have you. Let's start by talking about the book, The Lost Chapters, and how it came about.
Okay. The book is, I'll start with some background. I was clean and sober for many years, over two decades, and I had a relapse in 2013. And as a result of that, I went back to drinking, and I was only in that period of drinking for just a little over a year. But during that time, I had been mostly in a blackout, and I had I drove drunk and without a license and things like that, and I was arrested. And then later, I went to rehab. I got sober, and 6 months into my sobriety, I was sentenced to 90 days in Los Angeles County Jail. So that's the backstory, and the book came out of I describe the book as really a sort of a love story about books. But it's a little more than that. While I was incarcerated, a really brutal, brutal, demeaning, demoralizing experience, I developed these relationships with my fellow inmates, the women inside. And a lot of those relationships came about. I was given three books. I was allowed three books a week. They were sent to me. They had to come from Amazon or the bookseller themselves. And they were sent to me by my husband and friends. And through those books, I was able to develop friendships because really you have all this time inside. So we did a lot of reading. And but also it was sort of like a rediscovery for me of how literature can profoundly change and alter your experience of your own life. And so this book is as much about my experience in the system, from the perspective, by the way, of somebody who had never even had a parking ticket, you know, like maybe a parking ticket 20 years ago, never, nothing. I never, you know, I was a really good citizen. and then coming into this situation because of my disease and my addiction and, you know, having to take responsibility for the crimes I committed, you know, which I fully, you know, admit to and take responsibility for. But having this experience, you know, it just it was such a life-changing experience. And so the book kind of came out of that and out of how the books I read in there altered my perspective on my life and the lives of the other women inside and the criminal justice system.
Hmm. So in the beginning of the book, you have a book list in alphabetical order. How did you choose these books?
It's a good question because, you know, I was a little bit out of my mind. I was newly sober from a really, really bad experience, you know, after drinking for so long, not drinking or using drugs. It was really bad. And so my mind was a little befuddled. So when I look at this list, I often think, where did I come up with these books? You know, people had recommended some of them. Some of them were retreads. I wanted to read them again. I knew that I didn't want to read, you know, to get smarter. Like, I didn't want to read Cicero or, you know, the Iliad. You know, I wanted to be entertained because I knew I was going to be alone and lonely and bored. So I did choose a lot of the titles just because I thought they would entertain me.
Hmm. Yeah, interesting. I mean, I love the list, and it's funny that I finished your book yesterday. And I went and looked for Ethan Frome on my shelves because I've never read it, but I bought it a couple years ago because I thought I really need to read this book. And I started reading it and I love it. So thank you.
Yeah, it's a pretty terrific book, definitely.
Well, it's interesting in the Lost Chapters in your memoir, how you relate most of these titles to your experience as you're going through the 90 days.
Well, that was another. So I want to make it clear that I didn't have a good time in jail and that it's a heinous experience and that we need to kind of stand up and really look at what we're doing to people in our cities and our states and what we're doing with incarceration. Now, having said that, there was this sort of magical quality that was taking place while I was in there. And I didn't even really recognize it at the time. It was sort of only later that I understood that I had been fully and completely cared for. And one of those ways was that these books, they arrived, I didn't know what was coming when, and they arrived sort of magically right when I needed them. So I might have been going through a particular crisis, you know, like, for instance, dealing with some shame, and then the book about that came to me. You know, or dealing with having to be moved and leaving some security in one of the dorms I was in. And then this other book happened to be the one that came to me at that time that was delivered on that day or around that time that I was reading. So there was a sense that the books were stalking me and protecting me in a way and giving meaning and explanation to my experiences that seemed otherwise baffling and confusing.
Hmm. Well, that's sort of a magical realism experience, I would say. And, you know, I mean, I love it when things happen like that. But in your book, you talk about how in, I think you're talking about South America, South American writers are more open to magical realism, and that's why they can write it. And in our culture, we're not. We don't look at things like that. Oh, it's coincidence or it's, you know, whatever it is, but we don't assign any sort of magical or otherworldly qualities to it.
I mean, you're right about that. And it's so interesting to me because, well, one of the things I think in industrialized, you know, wealthy Western countries, we don't have to. You know, we have everything that we need. We don't have to figure out how to spend the day not eating, right, or how to not have a job. I mean, I think that some people would argue with me about that in this country because there is that. But we do have a sort of where we have plenty around us. And so we don't really have to have a reason to explain war. We've never, other than 9/11, nothing has really happened on our soil, right? There's a complacency, I think, in our culture. But as in my situation, when the reality was stripped out from under me and suddenly I was in this altered universe where the rules were entirely different, it seemed as if I was suddenly opened up to this other element that happens in the world, which is magic. And I don't like to call it coincidence. I think that there is something beautiful that functions in the world that my eyes were open to and that I would love for others to be able to experience. For me, it came out of hardship, and I think that that's where magical realism comes from, is in countries where there is quite a degree of hardship and poverty and crime and war and hunger. I think that our joy comes, you know, the joy and magical realism comes from that place.
Yeah, well, you know, I would imagine, I've never been in jail or prison, and I've known people who have been, and I would imagine that most incarcerated people are not looking for magic or not expecting to find it, and don't find it.
Yes and no. I mean, my experience of that place was that most of the people, if our listeners don't know yet, most of the people incarcerated in this country are people of color, and most of them are uneducated and impoverished, and generations of sort of violence and single parenting, and all kinds of foster care, things like that, and we perpetuate this incarceration of people like this. But on the other hand, when I was in there, in some ways, the way that people that live in hardship function is through creativity and a different vision of the world. And so I feel like in some ways my fellow inmates did bring to me a different way of looking at the world that did open my heart to something entirely different from my experience. I don't think they're going in there looking for magic. I don't think anybody in that place is happy. I think that for me as a white, woman who could pay my fines and get my license back and go to court and do all the things I needed to do, it's a different experience. But I think for the other women who don't have the means that I have, it's bitter. I mean, it was bitter for me. It was bitter enough for me, but it's a bitter experience. So I don't want to put this twist on it, like, we're having a great time. That's not the case. But I do think that the way to manage this despair is to try to find something different, a spiritual experience, something different than what we would normally, like the Netflix, That was just my experience of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, in reading some of the women that you were in there with, women in jail for stealing food, for instance, because they had no money, so they have to feed their kids, and they're in jail, for months and months, years. I mean, and as a reader, I'm going, how is this even possible? How could this even happen?
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting that you bring this up, because prior to this, I always knew, that there was a problem in this country about incarceration. And I had taught writing in jails. So I'd been, and I taught writing at Homeboy Industries, which is Greg Boyle and the largest gang intervention agency in the country. So I've worked with people who know intimately what it is like to be arrested and incarcerated, a lot of times not commensurate to the crime. In other words, a somewhat petty crime, getting 10 years, like possession of marijuana or something. I had always known that that was the case, and I had the, appropriate empathy, right, that my liberal mind, had. But the gift for me was really being able to experience it and to really, really see how corrupt and broken this system is that we have in this country, and the way that it spawns more and more bitterness and violence and addiction rather than doing anything to stop it. And so my eyes were opened, and I'm never able to unsee what I saw, and I consider that a gift to actually see the truth. It was amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Leslie Schwartz. Her memoir is The Lost Chapters, published by Penguin. Were you able to take any notes while you were there in jail?
Yeah, well, so what I did, you know, I talked about this at another event that I was doing. I was in such a state of shame at the time, which was somewhat cured by a book I read while incarcerated, and then my life now. And so that's not really my experience anymore. But I could not write. You were allowed to use a pencil, a golf pencil with no eraser, you know, those little golf pencils.
Yeah.
And you had to buy them unless you could get them from somebody. And you had to buy paper, this really awful brown paper, and it was all about 100% markup, you know, and you bought this off of your commissary. And so what I did I knew, because I'm a writer, and writers record experiences. That's what I do all day long. I'm thinking and writing stuff down that I see. But I had such a hard time writing about myself because I was not very proud of myself at that particular time. And it was deeply and profoundly painful to consider that I was in there and what I had done, because it extended much further than just jail. I'd hurt a lot of people. So what I did was, I knew instinctively that I needed to record this, so I wrote copious letters to my husband, pages and pages and pages. And every day I bought stamps, and every day I sent him a letter. And so it was, from beginning to end, really just a sketch of what was going on. And so there's some verbatim dialogue in my book that comes from, it's almost like reporting. Like I have all this information, you know, all of this reporting. I told him, I said, keep this. Don't throw my letters away. And so when I came out of jail and I saw this stack, I thought, well, at least I can write true to the experience, because I detailed everything. And the reason I detailed everything is there's nothing else to do in that place, you know. So I had plenty of time.
So did you foresee what the book would be, or did you just know, I'm a writer, I'm going to write something when I get out, I don't know what it's going to be, but it's going to be something?
Well, so that's a great question, too, because I'm really a novelist at heart, and I really had some issues about memoir. You know, I love reading memoir, but the idea of writing it didn't seem like fun to me. But I did have this other idea for a book, which is, because I was in a blackout most of that 414 days of my relapse, I wanted to find out what happened. And the purpose of that was, I wanted to be able to make amends to people and know what I had done, sort of asking them. So I came back, and I was like a reporter or a detective of my own life, and I went and I gathered all my arrest reports and doctors. I was in the hospital a couple times, my rehab that I went to. I got all the paperwork. I interviewed people on tape and put piece together day by day of those 414 days what happened. It was a fascinating story. And then hearing other people's story of my story, which was also another interesting thing that came up for me, because then I was questioning, what is the truth about what happens to any of us, right? So it was a really interesting exercise, deeply painful, but also I was shed my skin every time that I found something new and was able to repair it with another person. And that was going to be the book. It was going to be the detective story of my life. And it didn't really come out very well. It was a little fraught and overwritten, but in the back of my mind, I kept thinking about these beautiful books that I had read while I was incarcerated, and how they really, really grounded me and saved my life in so many ways. And I kept thinking, I'd love to do a book review of a few of them and talk from the perspective of somebody who's not free to go out there and, you know, live and talk about the books. And so I started to write this one, and it came out so fast. You know, I think it had been germinating inside me, you know, for a while. And so that's how this came about. It was sort of it was really the first book I wanted to write, but it was sort of came out second.
So you had written a draft of something else, like a complete draft, and you went, no.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
Well, what happened was I sent it to my agent, and I didn't like it. I didn't think that I could stand behind it as a writer. I didn't feel like it was well written. I felt sloppy to me. And so took it out to a couple people. One person, in fact, the person who originally bought my book, this one, The Lost Chapters, really loved it. But I said to my agent, you know, I don't want to do this book. Let's pull it. You know, I mean, even though I needed a book and I needed some money, I had principles, you know, I had an idea of what I could and could not stand behind. So we did. And then this came.
And then how much longer until you had this one? And did you finish the entire book before she submitted it? Or did you, you know, were you able with that editor to give him a few chapters and go, this is what it's going to be? And they said, yeah.
Well, so that the first time around, that was sort of how it went. My agent pitched it and we were giving chapters, but it was kind of a mess already from the beginning. And so this time I said, you know, even though I'm exposing all of this personal detail in this book, writing for me is a very private, solitary experience. And to share it with somebody before it's ready, it is not a good idea for me. I learned that from the previous experience, because I have to know what I'm doing, and I can't know what I'm doing until I'm a few drafts into the book. So I didn't want to show it to anybody except for I have a group of readers. But it did write itself, and I think within 9 months I had a first draft, and I did not have a whole lot of edits to do I have these trusted readers, and you know, it was pretty much ready to go, and then boom, it sold, you know, just sold.
Yeah. So with your readers, did you bring it to them early on? I mean, would you bring like a couple of chapters and say, you know, this is what I'm starting on, or did you have a lot of it written before you started sharing?
Well, so I have a group of, it's two other women, so there's three of us, and the way we work together, and it's funny you're talking about this because we've been on hiatus a little bit, and we're just, all three of us are just itching to go, so we just set a date to do pages of our new work. But the way we work as a group is that we meet once a month, and we submit whatever pages we have. We don't have page limits for each other, and we know each other so well, we don't even care the quality of our work, because at this point we're all sort of used to really hard criticism from each other, you know. And so it was as I went along, I just submitted pages, you know. And I think the very first time I submitted, though, I had a good chunk, maybe 50 or 60 pages, and you know, and then they just read along until I was done.
Nice. Well, we have so much more to talk about, so we're going to take a really short break and give you a chance to have a sip of water, and all of you, give you a chance to stand up and stretch. And if you're driving, of course, you're not going to do that. But stay with us. We'll be right back with more Leslie Schwartz. Don't go anywhere.
Such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you turns my whole world misty blue. just the mention of your name turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby, I think of the things we used to do, and my whole world turns misty blue. Heaven knows I've tried. Baby, when I say that I'm glad we're through, deep in my heart I know I've lied. I've lied. I've lied. Such a long, long time. Looks like I'd get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you, my love, my whole world.
Welcome back to Writers in Writing. I'm with Leslie Schwartz. Her memoir is The Lost Chapters, published by Penguin. And before we bring her back on, what do we have going on this week? Let's see. Tuesday night, September 18th, Victoria Patterson and Mark Sarvis will be at the Pen on Fire Speaker Series and Salon. You can find more on that at my website, penonfire.com. Let's bring Leslie on. We have so much to talk about. Hello.
Hello.
I'd love to hear you read from The Lost Chapters. Could you do that?
Of course. Since we were speaking about Ethan Frome, I'll read a short, very short section that's sort of based on my understanding of that book. And I'll just say that before I start, in the book, the two main characters, because they can't be together, decide they want to die together, and they get on a sled and they go sledding down a hill right into a tree. And I won't say what happens because I think everybody should read this book. But I'll pick it up from the end of that, and then I'll take us into jail. So it starts with one of the characters saying about the two that had died, that the two people that had been sledding. She says, "I don't see there's much difference between the Fromes up at the farm and the Fromes down in the graveyard, except that down there they're all quiet and the women have got to hold their tongues." What in the world did Wharton mean by that? Did she mean that it's a shame that women always have to hold their tongues? Or did she mean thank God for the grave so women will finally keep their mouths shut? I think she meant that women's lives are so devalued, in jail so over-prosecuted, out there so hobbled by isolation and dependency, that they have internalized their status in the world to the point of acting counter to their own best interests. Just like Maddie, who thought the best solution was to bash herself into a tree. Vina was bitter and jealous. The pool of dependency was shallow and the picking slender. There weren't enough men to go around. But Wharton literally crippled Maddie, making her a raging blank in illness and frustration. She seemed to be saying that in a world of oppression, even the hopeful end up bitter when resources are scarce and a woman's worth is constantly belittled and scorned. The secrets of chronic abuse, of chronic misogyny, of being chronically underpaid, of being chronically raped, sexualized, and brutalized, these secrets kill us. The shame blisters, flames, and burns. Sometimes the only way to deal with that, for some women at least, for the saddest ones, like those who would vote against their own interests, for example, is to adopt the prevailing culture's abuse and incarcerate their own self-worth and ram themselves into their own metaphorical elm tree on their way down the icy path. The women in jail had their secrets. Wynell told me hers, so did Ducky. But one thing I celebrated was that few of the women there kept their mouths shut. Even if in a general way, across the board, Linwood was a sad campus of self-loathing, I knew that there was also a vivid celebration of outrage, of joy, raunchy, muscular, and brave. Many of the women were there behind their men. Domestic abuse, for instance. I saw one woman come in with the most hideous beat-up face, to the point that she would probably be blind in one eye for the rest of her life. Her man had beaten her up. She told me he'd gone to jail, too, but he was already out. They were charging her, not him, with domestic violence. I had met some women who said they were locked up for selling drugs for their men, and one woman who had written a fake prescription so she and her man could get high on Oxy. I took the risk, she said, because I didn't want him to beat the blank out of me again. My fellow inmates were not silent women. These were women who knew how to get what they wanted, even if it meant manipulating the system. Unlike Ethan Frome's women, with their secrets, those I met in jail were open books. After I was released, I often wished that there was some way to take the whole lot of us, educate us, give us something to eat other than McDonald's, free us from the bondage of drugs and alcohol, provide us with jobs, and then see what would happen for women's rights on the out. What my eyes saw was a truth that people either don't want to believe or can't. The incarceration for women, for crimes of necessity, whether it's stealing food for their babies or money for their addiction, is society's dirty little secret. I met one woman who was sentenced to 6 months for stealing 2 pounds of turkey meat for her kids. Appalling. But in American culture, it's just business as usual to keep women of color and the mentally ill, including addicts, from attaining their power by keeping them uneducated, underfed, and incarcerated. The mainstream, regardless of party affiliation, is complicit. Incarcerating those with addiction and mental illness doesn't stop the cycle of addiction and criminal activity. I want to write a different book for us someday, the one that shows the world how unfettered our minds and hearts are, the one that shows our brilliance and our capacity for intellectualism, invention, creativity, the one that shows the Wynells and the Duckies and the Miss Browns of the world as they really are. Powerful, intelligent, loving, and creative. In my world, we would break them out of that system that without conscience or consideration entraps their best qualities so that they remain forever invisible, crippled, and despised.
Thank you so much. That was Leslie Schwartz reading from The Lost Chapters. One thing I found interesting about the book, about your story, was that you found a certain sisterhood in jail. I mean, you mentioned Wynell and Ducky, and, you know, that inmates weren't the problem. The guards were the problem.
Yeah. Yes, it's true. And that my fear about going into jail had nothing to do with the other inmates. I knew that I would be able to get along with them. It was, first of all, that just this idea of having your freedom taken from you, it's existentially just a bitter thought, you know? And so that, I don't know that I would call that fear, but I do know that it was depressing. But the other thing, because I'd had such a bad run-in with LAPD, who really, really physically abused me during my arrest, to the point of bruises and cuts and things, I feared the police. I feared the sheriff that ran the jail, and indeed, my fear was well placed for sure, from just based on my experience inside.
And they kept moving you around. They move inmates around, so no one can really ever settle in. It sounds like
that's correct. They, if we, it's, you know, they don't want us to make friendships or alliances. They don't want us to get comfortable. You know, it's one of those things. I say something in the book. It's like they stole the Nazi playbook, you know, because the way that you demean people and the way that you keep them in fear and that you keep them under your thumb is you don't let them get comfortable ever. And so, and you definitely don't let them, you know, hook up with other people and plan their escape, you know? So it's the whole thing is designed to keep you in just a state of constant anxiety and fear and loneliness because you do bond with people. There's no way you can't. And then they separate you, and it's devastating. I mean, that happened to me 4 times, you know, and it was really tough on me.
Was there a book that had the biggest effect on you? And as I was reading, I was wondering if it was Ruth Ezeki's novel.
Good. Very good reading. Very good eye there, because that was a book. I do talk about that book a lot because that book is amazing. I recommend it so highly if you haven't, if people haven't read it. It's just beautiful book and just lovingly written and full of insight. And she does have a section there about, you know, shame and, you know, why it's, you know, why it's such a useless, you know, emotion or whatever we call it. And it really, I remember reading that and closing the book and changing in that instance. And I remember feeling the shame I had go. It just dropped. And honestly, I have never felt it again. Hmm. And I'm a freer person because of it.
How did that happen?
Well, she talks about the difference between shame and conscience, and that, you know, shame, so this is me saying this, but because like this is what I came away with, that shame has no useful purpose. It's not evolutionarily important at all. In fact, what shame really does is kill us. It's really behind every suicide, you know. But she talks about the difference between shame and conscience, and that do we have a conscience? I had to ask myself, do I have a conscience? Because that's what matters. And I realized prior to coming in, I didn't even know I was going to be going to jail. I was told repeatedly that I would not have to go. And so, but I did make my amends. I had hit a car and did about $700 worth of damage. And so I met the person and I met him at a coffee shop and I wrote him a check, a good check, you know, and he got to fix his car and anything that I had to clean up. I knew already, I didn't need the criminal justice system to tell me you have to do this. I understood that it was my responsibility, making amends to my family, you know, standing by while they healed and my friends and all of that stuff. And so after I read that section in her book, I really thought I am a woman of conscience. You know, and I'm a good person, and I'm a kind person. And really, my biggest problem is that I have this disease. It was handed down genetically to me. And I made a choice to drink again, and it didn't go well. And I'm not going to fault myself for something that is human, but also that I can't help, biologically speaking. But did I take care of the mess I made? Without complaint, without self-pity. Yes, I did. And so she laid that out for me in such a clear way, which magically, I have to tell you, she did it within telling a story. So it was interesting, you know. It wasn't like she was telling me something. She was writing this amazing story. And I just came away knowing that I never had to feel shame again, that I, you know, I just knew I was a good person in spite of what the police and the prosecutors thought of me, you know, I knew I was okay.
Yeah. That book was interesting because, I think she's a Buddhist, priest, at least
a Buddhist nun.
And, it won the LA Times Book Prize for fiction, I think 3 years ago, A Tale for the Time Being. So that's interesting.
That's a great book.
That there's so much packed into that novel. But, you know, I also found it interesting what you were saying about Maxine Hong Kingston's The Woman Warrior, too. Can you talk a little bit about that and the effect that book had on you?
Yeah, that book was amazing because it was a very, very difficult book to read. And, you know, there's a lot of noise in that place. There's just, you know, it's hard to just sit and read. So I will say one thing, that when I finished it, I really felt that I had accomplished something. So that was kind of good for my self-esteem. But so what I really like about this book is that at the time that she wrote it, I'm speaking as a writer now, not as a reader. Mm-hmm. But at the time that she wrote this book, she was sort of breaking a lot of rules. And this, it appealed to me too, because it was a genre defier. Was it fiction? Was it memoir? Was it some, you know, amalgam of the two, some braided kind of, you know, genre that she was coming up with? Because she too uses a lot of magical realism, and her story is, it's a distinctly feminist book. And what I appreciated about it was that she refused to capitulate to what people in the industry and publishing and what the men in particular were pressuring her to do, which was, you know, make this more of a linear story, make this more accessible, you know. And she wrote this story that wasn't linear at all. And she even would say stuff in the storytelling of, well, this, I can't say that this really happened, but it did happen, you know. So she would flip things on, and in that way you would question, well, what is the truth about our lives? And if it's fiction, how are we finding a kernel of truth in fiction that can also affect us and change our lives? So I really love that she just defied, you know, expectation and sort of was a rogue writer and really didn't care what anybody said to her.
Hmm. Yeah. In the Lost Chapters, I think you talk about, I'm pretty sure you talk about how you like nonlinear novels.
Yes.
And are your novels nonlinear? Now I have to read them.
Not at all. Not at all. Although I will say, I find myself sticking to a timeline, although I will jump back and forth between past and present. So in that regard, they are nonlinear. But when you read somebody like Marquez or Kingston, you know, you're talking about overlapping narratives. You're talking about memory that, you know, and fiction and myth. And there's standards of truth that aren't, you know, adhered to. And so she's really inventing and sort of blurring the lines, not only between genres, but also between linearity and nonlinearity. And so that's the challenge of reading somebody like that. You know, but it's a great challenge to take on, you know, and I wished that I could have been sitting in my bed with a cup of tea because, you know, it was a really hard read, but I wasn't. And yet I came away so richly fulfilled by that book.
Well, for you as primarily a fiction writer, sounds like, what's the crossover? What was the crossover from fiction to memoir?
Well, I had a good story to tell, I think, in memoir that couldn't really be, I guess it could have been told in fiction, but, you know, I think, you know, I wanted to talk about the disease of addiction and alcoholism, and I wanted to talk about the brokenness of this system and how we were humiliated and that was part of the program, you know, unnecessarily humiliated. And I wanted to also talk about the hope because, you know, I did make it through all of this and I did change my life and we can change our lives. And I just felt like it had to be told as an experience. I felt very strongly, especially about the addiction stuff, because I think our culture just doesn't get it. We just want, like, why don't you remember Nancy Reagan, you know, just say no. Well, we would if we could, you know, that's the kind of thing. And so that it was really a personal, I just felt personally responsible in some way to talk about these issues that we don't like to talk about in this culture. And So that was, I think that was my primary motivation. I don't think I'll do it again, but one never knows.
So what's a working day like for you, a typical working day or writing day?
Well, I have a family, and so I don't, and, you know, I don't get a lot of time to, I have some traditional roles, you know, I'm a wife and a mom, and I do that stuff, you know, I make the lunches for my daughter, and, you know, drive her to school. So it is a challenge, but what I've managed to do is that I wake up very, very, very early, and I'll write before the sun rises. And it's usually a couple hours that I get to get in. And I do that every day, except when I'm just completely wiped out and I'll sleep through it. But that, and I just get a couple hours a day. And then I, you know, I'll start my regular life where I teach and I do all the other stuff. And I'm a mom and all that stuff. So it's really this very small two-hour window of time that I commit to. Pretty much 7 days a week. I do it on the weekends, too. And I love it. I love that hour of the day.
Does the fact that you have so much going on help you to get work done? Because sometimes, you know, when you have too much time, you just fritter it away. At least I do.
I am completely in agreement with you. I think that for me, if I have nothing to do, I won't write.
Ironic, right?
I don't understand that, but that's the truth.
So, you know, back to your friends in jail. You have maintained contact with some of them.
To the extent that one can, because these are fractured lives. And I did have one of them needed, she was pregnant, and I let her sleep on the couch for a little while till she could figure out what she was going to do. And then it's so interesting, your timing is so interesting, because a Ducky, one of the ones in the book, contacted me just a few days ago. And it was, she's been homeless and, you know, in her addiction. And she said, you know, I kept remembering that you, she said to me, I kept remembering that you wrote about me in a book, and no one had ever thought that I was ever important enough, and you did, she said, and I just decided that I was going to crawl out of the, she was at the root down in the river, and I wanted to, you know, I want to get clean. And so, and this is several years later now, right? So it was very emotional talking to her. But, you know, I'm not friends with them because their lives are so, you never know where they are, you know?
Mm-hmm. So did your apple tree survive? Talk about your apple tree.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. So I won't tell the whole story because it's pretty, no. This is one of those weird magical stories. But basically there was a fellow inmate who was able to take, we would get apples every day, and they were, I have to tell you, the worst apples on the planet. But they, with the seeds, she would put the toilet paper into the little Dixie cups people had for when they went to pill call, and they sprouted. And so she was locked up in the cell for a while, and I was in the day room, which is the open space. And she asked me to watch her sprouts, and so I did. And as thanks, she cut them in half and gave me half of them. And I brought it home. I was able, you can't take anything in, but you can take everything out of jail. And so I brought it home, and I went to a nursery, and I spoke to the woman there, and she said exactly what I needed to do to keep it alive. The apples don't really grow down here in the desert. They really need a lot of moisture up like up near Washington and Oregon. But I planted it, and I did everything I needed to do, and I left it out, and it rained, a punishing, punishing rain, and it drowned my tree.
Aww.
It was really sad because I really wanted it to live, but it was an amazing thing to be able to be in jail with this little thing that was growing.
It was growing.
It was really incredible.
Yeah, yeah, that was such a sweet part of the story. And your book is so powerful. I can't tell you how quickly I read it. And also added to my reading list. But in closing, I wonder if you have any advice to share with those writing, particularly memoir, and just trying to get their story down and deal with whatever they're dealing with in order to do that?
Well, what I come across a lot as a teacher is that a lot of people think my story is boring and who wants to read it? And so that's one case. And I'll, for people like that, I want to say that no story is boring. Nobody's story is boring. And that even if you're writing about a penny in the street, you can make that 500 pages of beautiful writing. It's language that matters, right? We're driven by language. And so we can create out of a small, maybe there's just a small thing that happened in your life, tiny, but it's a big thing to you. That's where language comes in. And then the other side of it is people have big stories, traumatic stories like mine, and, you know, others like Mary Carr, and, you know, big stories about trauma. You know, it's deep. It's dark, heavy lifting. So the way I thought about doing mine was I just did it one word at a time, and I plodded through, and if I felt sad, I knew that my sadness wasn't going to kill me. And again, because it hadn't, you know. And I think, again, I focused on how was I going to use language to tell this story. I wanted to make it beautiful. And so if I focus on the craft of writing, and if I focus on the language, and if I plod along 2 hours a day, one word at a time, you know, you can get through anything doing it that way. No expectations, you know, just do it. And don't edit or censor yourself. Write 5,000 pages because it's easier to cut than it is to add. You know, but just, it's always a question of reinvigorating the idea that your story is worth it and that you're worth telling this story, that there's a reason for it, in spite of all the negative self-talk we may give to ourselves. You know, story is imperative, especially now.
Especially now. Leslie, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the entire hour to be on the show. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. That was Leslie Schwartz. Her book is The Lost Chapters, Reclaiming My Life, One Book at a Time, published by Penguin. That's all the time we have today. We'll be back next week, Wednesday morning, 9 a.m. on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Have a great week. Writers out there, remember to stay in the chair.